So tonight, I want to give a talk based on the Mahagopalaka Sutta. That's the greater discourse on the cowherd. And I subtitled it, How to Be a Skillful Student of the Dhamma, because this is really what this is about. And this is an example of one of the suttas where the Buddha takes something that everyone would have understood 2,500 years ago, living in India, because there was lots of people herded cows. It was like everybody knew someone who herded cows. It was like a normal thing to do. Village life centered around the cows in a lot of cases. And so he takes this totally common thing and uses it as a series of images of how to lead the life of a skillful student. And it takes some translating, not only to get this translated from Pali to English, which it is, thank God, but it also, it's like we have to understand that a lot of what he's referring to, we have to sort of go, oh, what does that mean in terms of being a cowherd, let alone what does it mean, you know, in this more referential way. So some of the things I'm going to say are from me digging into commentaries on the sutta to find what did that really mean from the point of view of someone herding cows 2,500 years ago, right? So I want to start just by reading the opening section here. And so this is just the Buddha, you know, speaking to the bhikkhus, the sangha of renunciates that were around at the time. Bhikkhus, when a cowherd possesses 11 factors, he is incapable of keeping and rearing a herd of cattle. What 11? Here a cowherd has no knowledge of form. He is unskilled in characteristics. He fails to pick out flies' eggs. He fails to dress wounds. He fails to smoke out the sheds. He does not know the ford. Does not know what it is to have drunk. He does not know the road. He is unskilled in pastures. He milks dry, and he shows no extra veneration to those bulls who are fathers and leaders of the herd. When a cowherd possesses these 11 factors, he's incapable of keeping and rearing a herd of cattle. So, you know, when you read this, if you didn't have the context, it's like, what the heck is he talking about? Because, you know, this is like how people herded cows and what the duties of a cow herd were 2,500 years ago in North India. So then he goes on to explain. And I'm going to sort of go through this pretty much verse by verse, but actually I use some of the commentary I've come across in various places to talk about this. Actually, I have to get a book. Here we go. So he says, when a bhikkhu, now, how has a bhikkhu no knowledge of form? So now he's talking about how, what's the analogy? He says, if a cowherd has to have knowledge of form, how has a bhikkhu no knowledge of form? Here a bhikkhu does not understand it as it actually is. All material form of whatever consists of the four great elements, and the material form derived from the four great elements. That is how a bhikkhu has no knowledge of form. So this is talking about this way of seeing things in the world and how the world operates using what's called the four elements. And this is one way that the Buddha spoke to give people a way of sort of breaking down the material world and seeing that that's all that was there. There's just, here's these four elements. This is a way of looking to find a self and seeing that there can't possibly be a self there because it's just the four elements. This is one of the traditional ways of him doing that. But I want to read what Joseph has to say about this. This is, to be honest with you, not something I've explored a lot myself in my practice, but I find it sort of, it's fascinating because he's taken, this is like a very traditional South Asian idea that you see in other cultures, many other cultures as well. So he's talking about the four elements, which are, you know, earth, water, fire, and air. So the earth element refers to the common experience of solidity, the qualities of stiffness, hardness, or softness. So you could actually practice in a formal way, tuning into and noting the physical sensations of the body within this context. So this is a way you can actually look at what you're experiencing and sorting it out in a sense. Okay. So the earth element refers to the common experience of solidity, the qualities of stiffness, hardness, or softness. Next, the water element refers to the qualities of cohesion and fluidity. Imagine dry flour. On their own, its particles do not hold together. When we add water, the particles all adhere to one another, creating dough. According to the commentaries, the water element is not perceived separately from the other elements, but is what holds them all together. Which, when you think about our bodies, you know, our bodies are like, you know, 85% liquid, right? It's like everything else is dependent on the liquidity of our body. The fire element refers to temperature, heat, and cold. It is also the feeling of lightness in the body. The fire element functions in different ways. It is how something is warmed. It is that by which things age. It is excessive heat which burns things up. And there is a digestive heat. In Burma, they call this stomach fire. When it is strong, food gets well digested. When it is weak, there's stomach trouble. This understanding helps explain the Burmese fondness for very hot chili peppers. Although eating them creates a burning sensation, people enjoy it for its health benefits. Interesting. And the air element causes a movement in the body, the feeling of extension, expanding, distending. It is also the feeling of pressure. In meditation, when you are being mindful of the rise and fall of the abdomen, what you're really being mindful of is the air element. So this is a form. This is actually in the Satipatthana Sutta. There's a section that talks about this form of the meditative practice, where we essentially meditate on the four elements. And what he's saying here is this is one of the places in the sutta. This not a lot of places where this is mentioned, but this is one of those places where the Buddha encourages people to look at that particular way of seeing what we experience in it, what we are experiencing in our day-to-day lives, and seeing it in that way, we can see that that's all that's going on. There's just these four elements interacting with each other. And there's nothing more than that. Okay, moving on. Next one, he said the cowherd is unskilled in characteristics. You know, when I read that, I was like, oh, what the heck does that mean, right? Well, anyway, he says here, how is a bhikkhu unskilled in characteristics? Here, a bhikkhu does not understand as it actually is thus. A fool is characterized by his action. A wise man is characterized by his actions. This is how a bhikkhu is unskilled in characteristics. And what the Buddha is saying here basically is, you know, we have to understand what's wise and what isn't. Because how we see the world and how we operate in the world and how we are seen in the world depends on it. We have to have wisdom when we which allows us to understand things correctly, skilled in characteristics. Yeah. Then the next one was he doesn't pick out the fly eggs. Interesting. Well, interesting image, right? How does the bhikkhu fail to pick out fly's eggs? Here, when a thought of sensual desire has arisen, a bhikkhu tolerates it. He does not abandon it, remove it, do away with it, and annihilate it. And he goes on with the other forms, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion here, right? So this is how a bhikkhu fails to pick out fly's eggs. So here he's talking about the idea of wise effort. You know, we see something that has arisen in the mind or some action we're about to do, some intention we're about to do, or some intention that we're about to speak in a certain way. And we don't go, you know, I shouldn't do that. That's not wise. That's not skillful. I have to pick out that egg. Because if you don't pick out the eggs on a cow, then if the eggs hatch and there's lots of flies and it really irritates the cows. That's the actual, from the point of view of being a cow, why this is so important. And so the cow herd is always trying to, the flies would plant eggs on the cows and the cow herd would go along and pick off all these eggs. And it's sort of like picking off these unskillful thoughts, which is part of wise effort. You know, when we see that an unwholesome mind state has arisen, we do what we can to relieve ourselves of that unwholesome mind state. Then he goes on. He dresses wounds. Okay. How does a bhikkhu fail to dress wounds? Here, on seeing a form with the eye, a bhikkhu grasps at it, signs and features. Even though when he leaves the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade him. He does not practice the way of its restraint. He does not guard the eye faculty. And it goes through listing the other senses. So this is right, the first part of right effort. Know when something is going to cause the arising of unwholesome mind states. And don't go there. Dress the wounds. Like, you know, it's like this is a habitual pattern of mind that we go through, and we know, oh, I know where this goes. I know where my mind's going to end up. I know how this is going to bring up that story, and I'm going to start spinning about it and get caught in that whirlwind of emotion again. Lose serenity, lose concentration, lose focus. And so let's not do that. So this is another part of wholesome effort, wise effort, is seeing how what's going on right now leads to something more. You know, it's a wound in our mind, it's an old habit. Mental habit of letting ourselves drift into difficult mind states. Yeah. As he says, there are unwholesome states of covetousness and grief. Oh, don't want to go there. Okay, then. Then we hit this sort of tricky space, because these two, you know, if we're not careful, this whole idea of right effort in this way can lead to thoughts along the lines of, you know, you're just so busy taking care of yourself. You're so busy protecting yourself. That's all this stuff is about. This Buddhist stuff is about just protecting yourself from these unwholesome things. And you just dwell on this unwholesome stuff all the time. You know, you get caught up in that negative mind space, in a sense. But that's not the case. And I want to actually read from a different sutta here. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya, which is, Samyutta means the collected discourses. So this is collections of discourses about similar in topic, and they put them all together in one place. So you can sort of see here's all the different ways the Buddha spoke about this particular topic. And there are like sections like with 170 suttas, talking about the seven factors of awakening, or the five aggregates of clinging. So this is like, here's all the different ways you might want to think about this that the Buddha spoke of. So it's interesting from a different way when you study it, because it's like, oh, it's like using different images, using different, slightly different wording. Anyhow, in this particular sutta, the Buddha has been talking to this king and queen who basically say that there's no one dearer to them than themselves. There's no one, great king, more dear to me than myself. But is there anyone, great king, more dear to you than yourself? And the king replies, no, for me too, Malika, there's no one more dear than myself. And our first reaction to that is, why, these people are kind of selfish. It's like, well, here they are dwelling on themselves all the time. You know, there's nothing more important than myself. It seems, really, according to our contemporary culture and a lot of how people think, but here's what the Buddha says. He basically says, no. There's nothing wrong with this at all. And then he has a sort of poetic four-line answer to this problem. Having traversed all quarters with the mind, one finds none anywhere dearer than oneself. Likewise, each person who holds himself most dear, hence one who loves himself should not harm others. That's the reason. It's like, if I hold this dear, then I have to hold that dear as well, because I know that person does the same thing. If this is dear to me, then that's dear to them. How could I possibly harm them? It's an interesting way to think about things. It's like, if I see the importance of this, without clinging, without sort of becoming infatuated or something, but just sort of like, yeah, this is, I need to keep this going. I have to take care of this body, mind. So that's all anyone else is doing. It's like a natural human emotion to want to take care of yourself. A wholesome natural emotion. Nothing wrong with it at all. It's the interesting way to think of it, you know. Then he goes on. The next one is he smokes out the sheds. This is what a skilled cowherd would do, is smoke out the sheds. So the sheds, this is where the cows are kept when they're not grazing out in the fields and stuff, right? What the heck is this? I mean, first of all, what does he mean by smoking out the sheds? Well, we sort of have this image, you can sort of see this image, right? But basically, if you didn't smoke out the sheds where the cows were kept on a regular basis, this is from the commentaries I read, the sheds are full of gadflies and mosquitoes and other pests. And smoking them out gets rid of the pests, especially during the rainy season when the cows can't go out and graze so much. You know, the rainy season lasts as much as 3 months, and the cows are in the shed most of the time during the rainy season because they can't go out into the fields and graze because it's all mud and everything's flooded, right? And then, and this is what the commentary said, I'm just going to read this. The insects then harass the cows so that they do not properly rest during the night. And in the day, they are unable to feed or drink properly and will fall sick. This is a warning against taking only those parts of the Dhamma that you like and avoiding the parts you don't like. Yeah, that annoy you. It teaches the Dhamma properly as he has learned it, is what the commentaries, what the actual sutta says. So it's like, here's what the Buddha taught. We can't sort of pick and choose. We have to smoke out the sheds so that this is the shed we got to smoke out. We got to smoke out this shed called our heart mind and get really clear that we have to take it all. We can't sort of pick and choose and have just the parts we like and ignore all the rest of the stuff. It's an interesting, once again, interesting idea that, because that's what people do all the time. Like they'll take, you know, and not, this isn't just Buddhism, that you see this happen in any tradition that has a scripture of some sort, where people will quote chapter and verse of something and say, see, that's what it says. That's why this is true. And they haven't taken the whole picture. You know, they haven't taken the entire teachings in and synthesized them in their mind. They've picked the few little pieces that they like or that they want to use for whatever reason they have to use them. You know, often not so wholesome reasons, actually. And so we have to, you know, smoke out the shed in our brain, in our mind, in our heart, and take, so there's no, all those things that annoy aren't going to annoy. We're just going to take it all and be happy cows. Right? We're going to be happy that way because we're going to let it all come in. Okay, that's smoking out the shed. Knows the ford. So a ford, of course, is a place where you can take cattle across from one side of a stream or a river to the other, which is because these herds, you had to keep them moving because they'd eat all the grass in a certain place and then you'd move them along to the next place. And then, so if you didn't know the ford, you got stuck. You couldn't go any further. The what the Buddha puts this on, he says, when a bhikkhu does, how does a bhikkhu not know the ford? Here a bhikkhu does not go from time to time to those bhikkhus who have learned much, who are well versed in tradition, who maintain the Dhamma, the discipline and the codes, and it does not inquire and ask questions of them thus. So he's saying, for us to not know the ford means we sort of think, oh, I can do this all myself. I don't have to go and have sangha. He's talking about the importance of sangha, how central sangha is to the Buddha's teachings and the practices that the Buddha teaches. That going and being with other people, and in particular, in this case, he's talking about people who are sort of further along the road in terms of the practice, who can explain things and can answer questions. You know, we get caught in like ill-conceived ideas of what things mean. We don't sort of open ourselves to other interpretations. We don't get the full story. We get caught in that uniquely Western/American idea that, well, man's got to do what a man's got to do, and I can do this all myself. You know, I don't need anybody's help. And that's not true. Once again, this is from the Samyutta Nikaya again. And here, in this particular verse, Ananda, the Buddha's main helper to many years of his life, comes to the Buddha and he's all excited. He's figured something out and says, "Venerable sir, this is half the holy life. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship." So he's saying, you know, I think, you know, having Sangha is really important, right? Half the holy life. Not so, Ananda. This is the entire holy life. Ananda, that is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. When a bhikkhu has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, it is to be expected that he will develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path. This is all of the Dhamma. And that's what the Buddha is saying in this verse. See, this is how important Sangha is. You know, we can't do this alone. Oh, well, I suppose I shouldn't say we can't. It's extremely difficult to do this alone and to have others who are on the path and who you can go to and discuss things or go to and listen to someone teaching is really, really important part of the practice. And that's that when we know the fort, we know that there's places we can go where we can do that. You know. Okay. Then he knows. Then the next one says that he knows what it is to have drunk. This is the cowherd. He knows what it is to have drunk. What? Huh? What's this about? And this here's what he's talking about from a cowherd's point of view is he knows which of the cows needs to drink, which do not. And how various cows in the herd can drink in an orderly manner without crowding or jostling one another. In other words, he can control the cows as they all get the water they need, one after another, in a certain way, that because the cowherd is knowledgeable of his herd, he knows how to make this work. And then all the cows will have drunk. And if he doesn't know that, then, you know, some cows are greedy and they push you out of the way and they won't move out of the way when the younger cows got it, you know. And this is likened to skillfully consuming the Dhamma. Being gladdened by it. It gains inspiration from hearing the Dhamma. That's the image that this translates to. It's like we can being skillful in consuming the Dhamma means we actually pay attention and we start to see the patterns of the Buddha's teachings. And we don't sort of just pick out certain pieces and ignore certain pieces or anything like that. We start to see how the Buddha's teaching has a certain flow to it that can sometimes get lost in because we sort of emphasize one thing and not another thing so much, and this is which means we're letting ourselves drink some and letting other parts of us not drink at all, and we have to. So once again, this is like being careful to sort of take it all in and being gladdened by it. That's the key. That we actually, not only do we have to consume the Dhamma, we have to be gladdened by it. I love, that's a great phrase, I think. Which means we gain inspiration from hearing the Dhamma. Mm. Okay. Knows the road. What does this mean? This is another thing the cowherd has to do. The foolish cowherd does not know his way around, where it is safe and where it is not. He takes the cows into places infested with lions, tigers, or wild beasts will frighten or attack the cows, or where there are thieves. So knows the road. What does that translate to as a student of the Dhamma? This is knowing the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is a road. That's like, that's the image that is, it's called the path, the Eightfold Path. So a skillful student of the Dhamma actually understands the Eightfold Path, which is like a lifetime's work, by the way, to actually understand, to truly understand the Eightfold Path. He doesn't get lack or misled by his lack of understanding or his misinterpretation of certain things. Because the thing about a lot of the Buddha's teachings, they're quite pithy, like simple phrases. And you can sort of get caught in thinking about them in ways that are not, that lead you astray. You think, oh, I've got that figured out, but you really haven't, and so it's important that we actually understand and then follow the Eightfold Path. We have to stay on that road, and we have to know that road very clearly. Otherwise, we wander off into dangerous places and where the lions and the tigers are, or the thieves, or whatever you want, however you want to think about it. Then the next one was that this cowherd has to be, is unskilled in pastures. Once again, doesn't know the good places with the right environments, safety, good grass and water, where the cows, he doesn't know the places he can, if he's on the road, but then he has to get to certain places where the cows can sort of settle and enjoy what's there. And take advantage of the good grass and the good water. This is likened to understanding the Four Noble Truths. And this is, once again, quite critical to understanding. I want to go back. I skipped over one thing I wanted to read here. This is about knowing the road. And this is one of those ones where he's talking with a Brahmin. And the Brahmin keeps asking him questions, and the Buddha answers that, and that causes the Brahmin to ask another question. And he's been talking about the five senses, or the six sense doors. But what, Master Gautama, what is it the mind takes recourse in? The mind, Brahman, takes recourse in mindfulness. But what, Master Gautama, what is it that mindfulness takes recourse in? Mindfulness, Brahman, takes recourse in liberation. But Master Gautama, what is it that liberation takes recourse in? Liberation, Brahman, takes recourse in nibbana, in final enlightenment. And then the Brahmin goes on, but Master Gautama, guy can't stop, right? What is it that nibbana takes recourse in? And the Buddha says, you've gone beyond the range of questioning, Brahmin. You weren't able to grasp the limit of questioning. For Brahmin, the holy life is lived with nibbana as its ground. So that's, Once you've achieved nibbana, there's nothing more to figure out. So there's no more questions to ask. And this is a theme that occurs in other places in the sutta as well, where the Buddha, actually gives lists of questions that you shouldn't even bother thinking about. The most common one that you see in the sutta is people are talking about, well, what happens after death? Especially what happens to you, the tathagata, after death? What's going to happen to you? And they can give all these different theories of it's going to be this way or it's going to be that way. And They keep saying, no, 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 no. And they say, well, wait a second. You said no to everything. How can that be? He says, well, it's an irrelevant question. It's an irrelevant question because it just, you don't need to know the answer to practice. You know, how did the universe begin? How's the universe going to end? You know, those sorts of philosophical questions that fascinate, I think, sometimes Western philosophers. Those sorts of questions, the Buddha says, don't waste 1 minute thinking about them. Don't try and figure this stuff out. It's just a waste of time. And that's what he's getting at here. When you truly understand the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths, it's like, just take them for what they are. You don't have to sort of go beyond this. You don't have to sort of put this into some esoteric context. These are very simple, practical, straightforward things in their own way. And don't get caught up in that philosophical debating mode when it comes to looking at the Dhamma. Just take the Dhamma for what it is. When he says that you have to understand the Four Noble Truths, this is quite explicitly stated. This is in the Satipatthana Sutta, where the Buddha is actually speaking very directly about the last stage of Satipatthana, the last thing we have to be able to do when we are progressing through the stages of meditation in the four foundations of mindfulness. This is the very last thing. He knows as it really is, this is dukkha. He knows as it really is, this is the arising of dukkha. He knows as it really is, this is the cessation of dukkha. He knows as it really is, this is the way leading to the cessation of dukkha. So all this practice, all the practice we do, eventually leads us right back to this one basic thing, the Four Noble Truths. But it's like he knows as it really is. In other words, this isn't some intellectual understanding. You know, the last thing we have to do in this practice, in the end, is to actually have a intuitive, insightful, experiential understanding of the Four Noble Truths. That's the last thing you have to do. It's interesting, huh? It's like, this is where it all starts. And here we are, we loop around and end up right where we started. But now it's like at a much deeper level. Like in the beginning, we take the Four Noble Truths as, yeah, that's interesting. That sort of makes sense. And it starts us wanting to practice, right? But in the end, we have to come right back and sort of acknowledge that our understanding has always been somewhat intellectual. And now we have to sort of go deeper, somehow connect to these in a non-intellectual way. And know them as they really are. So I thought that was interesting. Yeah. Then the next one he says, he doesn't milk dry. What the heck is that about, right? Because, you know, that's one of the things the cowherd does is he doesn't milk dry. Because if he does, he milks the cows dry so there's no milk for the calves. The calves may then hunger or even die. So if you milk a cow dry, then because this is in a tradition where the calves weren't separated, right? You know, now our production cattle world, you know, calves are taken very quickly away from their mothers and fed in different ways. And anyhow, I don't want to go there because I'll just get upset and start ranting about the dairy and meat industry. And I don't want to go there. But here he's talking about, so what does that mean from the bhikkhu's point of view? He says, It doesn't take or demand too much from those who offer support. Remember, in this tradition, the bhikkhus were totally dependent on the people in the surrounding villages to support them in terms of food and helping them get the material to build a little shelter and their robes and medicines. Those were the four requisites. But so if you were too demanding, if you no, I don't like this kind of rice. I want better rice than this. You know, you got to cook me something special when I come around with my bowl that you're going to put food in that I'm going to eat once a day. Or no, this cloth isn't good enough. You know, whatever too demanding means. It's like, that's like you're taking too much from people. How does that fit into our world of, you know, being householders and living in the world and practicing the Dhamma? It's like, if we're not careful, we get into thinking that we're owed stuff, that we demand too much. I'm owed the right to always have XYZ, you know, whatever it is, you know, everybody else has one. I'm owed that. And we start to sort of believe in these ideas that somehow we should have stuff because, well, that's what everybody has. This is just a way of thinking of like, we want to literally milk the culture dry. Everybody, you know, because if everybody had everything, then it would have way too much stuff in the world, basically. And so it's that way of like being able to go, yeah, I don't really need that. I don't need that to live in the world and do my practice. Sort of leading this really simple life, I think, is where this fits into the life of us as householders, because we don't actually go around with a bowl and collect our food every day from the people around us who support us, which is what a bhikkhu would do. And then the last thing on this list was he is incapable of keeping and rearing a herd of cattle. It's because, and the image was in the sutta that he couldn't, he didn't honor the older, wiser cows. He didn't take special care of the leaders of the herd, because cows are herd animals and certain of them are the leaders who take, you know, they've been around long. They know when I go to get to this ford, because I've crossed this ford, you know, a zillion times in my cow life, I know how to get across and help. I can sort of show the way. You know, you don't want to go too far to this side. You want to stay more on this side. And the cows are smart, just like anybody else, any other creature. And certain cows need to, you got to give them special attention. You got to venerate them. Because this is how you keep the herd cohesive. You know, you have to understand that certain of those cows are leaders. And then the image that in the sutta, what the Buddha says is that means you have to maintain physical, verbal, and mental acts of loving kindness towards senior teachers in the lineage. In other words, you have to, this is talking about respect. You know, that there are, you have to know that there are certain people who are much wiser than me. And, you know, I'm thinking about me. I have to know that there's people who are much wiser than me, that I have to respect their knowledge and respect the fact that they've dedicated their lives to this practice. And really pay attention when they speak. One of the things. I have this feeling towards a couple of teachers of mine. Joseph Goldstein in particular is, he just lives the Dhamma. Just lives it. And I really respect him for that. And whenever I'm fortunate enough to hear him teach, I go, oh, got to pay extra attention tonight to do this Dhamma talk. Because he's going to say stuff that just like sinks right in. It's quite amazing to be around people like that. But we have to respect them. We have to have, you know, verbal, physical, and mental acts of loving kindness. I remember once I was on one of the very first retreats I was on with Joseph. And, you know, it was after a meal and people were just standing in line to go wash their dishes, right? A pretty normal thing to do. And I was astounded. There was Joseph standing right in front of me going to do his dishes. I'm thinking, and my mind went, God, he's got to have more important things to do than wash that plate. So I just, you know, bowed to him and took his plate, and he bowed back to me, and he went off and did what he had to do next. And I just washed his dishes. No big deal. It's like one more plate and fork to wash. It's not like a big thing, right? But it was like offering that respect. And just something that seemed so natural to do. And it has to be like that. We have to sort of go, oh yeah, this is how we deal with these great beings. And there are great beings in this lineage that I have great respect for. So, okay. So that's this rather interesting list, I think. It's like, here's the things we have to pay attention to if we want to actually be skillful students. It's quite a long list. It's not a list I really ever paid attention to before I started to study this particular sutta and look into the discourses behind it. But it seems to me it hits all the highlights of the Buddha's teachings, right? Things like the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, wise effort, which is part of the Eightfold Path, and being careful and leading a virtuous life, and then there's the whole teaching on the four elements, which is one of the forms. There's actually in the Satipatthana Sutta one of the 13 teachings on how different ways we could actually practice mindfulness is to be mindful of the four elements. Like we could actually sit down for a particular sitting and just say, all I'm going to do is I'm going to note things. But I note something, I go, and what element was that? And start noting actually the elements as they arise. And now I'm going to be totally honest with you. I've tried this, it drove me nuts. But some people I know would think, this is like the cat's pajamas. This is absolutely the best way, the best form to practice. Just for some people, it works. And maybe it didn't work for me because I didn't hang with it long enough, probably more than anything else. I suspect that's what it is. I was like, this is just too strange for me. It was too much. I found my mind spending too much time trying to figure things out. Like, well, what element was that? You know, as opposed, you know, wasn't clear. And so I think, anyhow, it's just a little sidelight there. So that's this particular sutta. Just laying out very, I think, quite stepwise, I think. Here's all these things we need to pay attention to. When we're seriously practicing, we want to practice, we want to be a skillful practitioner. We can't sort of ignore some of this stuff and just pick out the things we like. This is all these different pieces have to all be attended to all the time. Okay. So I want to read a piece of poetry here. Sort of shift the energy a little bit, but I'll actually sort of, in some interesting way, I thought this poem sort of summed up what I've been talking about all evening. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. And this is a poem called Still Point. There's a quality of stillness so rare that the air shimmers in its presence. It's there between our eyes. We hear it when we dare to speak the truth. It vibrates with the music of life, dances in the wind, breaks forth from the trees into a clearing just as the sun rises, and settles into silence once again. There's a quality of stillness so rare that I am bared to the very marrow of my bones before it. May I choose never to be clothed again. So now I'm just going to, as usual, I'm going to pause. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.